This is the takeaway for Wednesday, July 22nd, 2015. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And there is a dispute right now between the federal government and local governments on how to treat undocumented immigrants. The federal government wants the ability to deport at will and wants the cooperation of local law enforcement to do that. But many communities do not want to create a climate of fear on their streets where every undocumented worker fears anyone in uniform. The challenge, as localities see it, is to embrace undocumented workers, keep the peace, and await some comprehensive immigration reform from Washington. The consequence of this dispute, though, is that sometimes in communities, the federal government knows a lot more about certain undocumented individuals than localities do, and no cooperation means no sharing of information. Earlier this month, 32-year-old Catherine Steinle planned an evening with her father strolling along San Francisco's Embarcadero, a waterfront walkway and major tourist destination. Her plans were cut short when shots rang out around 6:30 that evening, and Catherine was hit in the chest. She died at San Francisco General Hospital later that night. The alleged gunman was Juan Francisco Lopez Sanchez, an undocumented immigrant from Mexico with a long record. Catherine's father, Jim Steinle, who had his arm around his daughter when she was shot, testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee this week.
The alleged murderer is an undocumented immigrant who has been convicted of 7 felonies in the U.S. and already deported 5 times. Yet in March of this year, he was released from jail and allowed to stay here freely because of those legal loopholes.
Legal loopholes, that's what Steinle calls the tension and disagreements between the federal government and state and local governments on immigration policy that he says made his daughter a casualty.
The U.S. has suffered a self-inflicted wound in the murder of our daughter by the hand of a person that should have never been on the streets of this country.
Last fall, the Obama administration put a stop to a program called Secure Communities, a national immigration enforcement program that enlisted the help of local police to aid with the Obama Accelerated Deportation Program. It was unpopular. More than 360 jurisdictions opted out of the program, including San Francisco, where Catherine Steinle was killed. The Priority Enforcement Program, or PEP, is another attempt to get cooperation between the federal government and local communities. So how is it different? And will communities like San Francisco be willing to participate? Joining us now is Mark Rosenblum, Deputy Director of the U.S. Immigration Policy Program at the Migration Policy Institute in Washington. Mark, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
So explain to me, first of all, whether there should be cooperation between the federal government and local governments and how you see this dispute or difference of opinion.
Well, you definitely want some level of communication between DHS, the Department of Homeland Security, and local police, because there are so many more local police officers that it's a huge force multiplier for DHS to be able to take custody of people who come in through local law enforcement.
So for all of the complications that the Secure Communities program might have produced on the streets of the communities that opted out, you have to admit that not being able to tip off San Francisco law enforcement about this alleged gunman, Juan Francisco Lopez Sanchez, is an irresponsible consequence.
Right. And actually, the way the program works, the way Secure Communities worked and the way the new PEP works, PEP, is that it's pretty seamlessly integrated into the law enforcement process. So when a local police department arrests somebody and then books them, when they send their fingerprints to the FBI for criminal background checks, DHS automatically gets a copy of those prints, and they can check it against immigration databases and determine if the person is potentially removable and check that against their immigration history and their criminal history to see if it's a priority and the person should be deported.
What is the reaction of communities? And let's just talk about people on the streets who are very inclined to be fearful of people in uniform, but it's not in the interests of communities to have large numbers of people on the street who are literally afraid of people in uniform. You need them to be much more forthcoming to law enforcement. But what do they think the impact of the federal government looking so closely at these communities is?
Right. That's been one of the biggest concerns about Secure Communities, is that because law enforcement gets so seamlessly integrated into immigration control, it really undermines the relationship between police and law-abiding immigrants. And so it prevents police from doing the good community policing that they want to do. So many police chiefs, have argued that this program has been really bad for public safety. And it's also diverted sort of scarce police resources away from doing crime control and force them to, you know, spend time and money on holding people for DHS and being involved in immigration enforcement instead.
Do you think it's sustainable to have a policy on the local level which basically says, look, we're going to keep the peace here. We're not going to do any, you know, sweeps in these communities. Please tell us about the really bad apples and we'll take them off the street. But we're just going to keep the peace until Congress gets their act together. Is that sustainable?
Well, I think what you described is exactly what the Obama administration is trying to do with PEP, is to sort of scale back secure communities, which sort of overshot and became too large a presence and too close of a connection between local law enforcement and DHS. And under PEP, they're trying to focus exclusively on the real bad apples, people who've been convicted of serious crimes or are believed to be a threat to public safety. The other problem with secure communities that PEP tries to address is that it imposes some controls on how people get detained and passed over to Homeland Security to ensure that you're not wrongfully detaining people for whom there's no probable cause that they're removable, and not wrongfully detaining U.S. citizens beyond the, you know, their time in the criminal justice system.
Do you think these changes are likely to turn around San Francisco, which thinks of the sanctuary policy that it's adopted as something that it's very popular, even given the Catherine Steinle murder?
Well, the DHS is really reaching out to individual jurisdictions on a case-by-case basis and trying to find a way to get them to cooperate on these highest priority cases by negotiating specific protocols that they're comfortable with. You know, it just rolled out officially at the beginning of July. So the real test is going to be, is it successful at focusing more narrowly on the administration's enforcement priorities? And that's actually something that you already saw over time with secure communities. Initially, when that program rolled out, most of the people deported through secure communities were non-criminals or people who had been convicted only of very minor offenses. But over time, it got increasingly focused on people who had been convicted of serious crimes. And so hopefully we'll see that that's the case with PAP even more so. And I think that would convince cities like San Francisco to find ways to cooperate with DHS.
Mark Rosenblum, Deputy Director of the U.S. Immigration Policy Program at the Migration Policy Institute, speaking to us from Washington, D.C. Thanks so much, Mark.
Thank you.
Let's test that proposition. We go now to Leslie Beristain Rojas, who's immigration and emerging communities reporter for KPCC in Los Angeles. Leslie, can the federal government pull off this cooperation model with local communities and just wait for reform from Washington without having more shootings like the Catherine Steinle case in the Bay Area? What do you think, Leslie?
Well, they're certainly trying, but I mean, there has been some blowback brewing for a while. And I would say the shooting is really kind of, you know, the blowback really kind of hitting peak right now. You already had some resistance, you know, back some months ago. You know, there were some ICE officials that were complaining that there were people that were, you know, out that they could have had, you know. And I don't know if you remember a situation where they rounded up some people and said these were people that we would have detained otherwise. PEP is in some ways an answer to, for example, California's Trust Act, which took effect last year, that was setting boundaries as to how states and ultimately local governments cooperate with ICE. They were saying, okay, well, you're going to ask us for detainers, we'll hand over people who meet a certain bar. So PEP is in some ways trying to replicate what the state and what other jurisdictions were doing in response to secure communities. So we'll see. But, you know, you're going to get some resistance even to PEP. Even the advocates call it PEPCOM because, of course, at the outset, as Mark was explaining, the fingerprint system is still happening. People are still getting identified at the beginning. It's still going to DHS. The difference is at the tail end.
What's the possibility that this whole thing will be exploited by interests both within ICE and within local communities to take these outlier cases like the Catherine Steinle case, which is very unfortunate and tragic, but use it to basically paint the entire program as impossible to maintain, and that suddenly it's a sort of a stockade mentality between the federal government and these localities?
Well, interesting that you mention that. Right now, of course, in Los Angeles County, supervisors are still kind of out as to how much, to what degree they're going to participate in PEP, right? So the County Board of Supervisors used to have a program called 287G. LA and Orange counties were the last two counties in the state, really, that had this older program in which basically, they allowed the federal government to deputize deputies to go into the jails and actually do in-person screenings for people's immigration status. Inmates, these were people who the county argued could be missed by the secure communities database model, right? So there's a very heated debate about that locally. And in the end, county supervisors voted 3-2 to do away with 287G and just go ahead and implement PEP, gave the sheriff's department 90 days to seek input, hold community meetings with a report back in August. At that point, they're going to determine how closely they cooperate with the federal government with PEP. It was a heated debate back then, but not nearly as heated as it is now. So yes, you know, in the most recent meeting after the San Francisco shooting, you had lots of people who were turning out. And, you know, these are activists that had already been vocal, but became much more vocal with many more people joining their numbers, saying that the county needs to, in fact, you know, implement maximum cooperation. And I spoke with a deputy for one supervisor yesterday who said, yes, that's what he's going to push for. So we may see this becoming much more of a debate when it comes in August to decide how much the county can cooperate with the federal government or not. As you know, PEP does give local jurisdictions more leeway as to just exactly how closely they want to work with federal government.
But within that leeway, because of the Steinle case, the pendulum may be swinging the other way, as you've seen it there down in Southern California. Leslie, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Leslie Berenstein Rojas is immigration and emerging communities reporter for KPCC in Los Angeles, trying to assess the question of how sustainable is cooperation between the federal government and localities while all of those interests wait for Congress to act on immigration reform.
Support for The Takeaway comes from TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org. And Curious.com, helping people grow skills in areas like programming and parenting. Broadcasting a live discussion on how to raise an adult this Thursday with author Julie Lithcott-Hames at 9:30 p.m. Eastern. Learn more at Curious.com/PRI.
In our series about bail this week, Presumption of Innocence for Sale, we wondered, with so many people dissatisfied with the bail system right now, so many judges and prosecutors screaming for reform, who is it who supports the current system, basically the way it is? Nicholas Wachinski, retired executive director of the American Bail Coalition, says he would not get rid of the money for freedom principle in the U.S. bail system at all.
No, getting rid of the use of financial conditions of bail entirely is not something that the bail agents or the American Bail Coalition can support. We believe there is value in keeping those types of releases in the system.
Maybe he and the 14,000 bail agents or bail bondsmen working each day in the U.S. justice system are comfortable with the way things are, because the whole pretrial detention system in the U.S. is an $8 billion a year operation. And the bondsman gets something like between $2 and $3 billion each year in fees and other financial charges for basically being insurance agents. And that's what the bail system really is, a giant insurance market putting up money to be paid if defendants don't show up for trial. Defendants are assessed for flight risk by a judge, but then they are also assessed for risk by the bondsmen and the insurance companies who underwrite the promises that say defendants will show up. Individual bail amounts have been increasing in America. Average bail amounts have risen by $30,000 since 1992, according to the Bureau of Justice Statistics. So we sent two of our takeaway team out to see what bondsmen themselves think of this apparently booming business.
We are outside City Hall in the Manhattan Detention Complex in downtown Manhattan. We're facing four bail bonds places right now.
Shop fronts near the courthouses and jails in New York City are crowded with bail bond shops.
I am the first guy from the court. I am directly across the street from the jail. So location, location, location.
This fellow might be the first person you talk to after a lawyer if you find yourself in the criminal justice system.
My name is Eduardo Guilarte, and I'm a California bail agent and opening up a new agency here in New York. It's called Bail NYC.
Bonding agents like Eduardo are licensed and regulated by the state in which they operate, in this case, New York State. They run on the principle that premium rates should not be excessive.
So basically what happens is, here you are, you've been arrested, your bail is $50,000. So what do? You come to an agency like mine and you say, listen, I got this case, and it says, okay, basically you're sort of like asking me for a loan. I'm like a bank, and you're asking me for a $50,000 loan. My interest rate is governed by the state. So New York says, from this amount of dollars to this amount of dollars, you'll charge 10% interest rate. If you walk into your banker and you say, give me a $50,000 loan, the banker is going to say, what's your collateral? Same thing in this industry.
What can be used as collateral? Real estate, stocks, bonds, personal credit, credit cards, cars, jewelry, whatever you've got of value, usually they'll take it. But if you come up short and can't post bail or put up enough for collateral, then you might be out of luck. And that's when you end up in jail awaiting trial. In New York City, in an attempt to ease the burden of bail on nonviolent offenders, the city just announced nearly $18 million to end bail for low-level or nonviolent crimes, releasing up to 3,000 people who otherwise would be stuck in jail. Good news for criminal justice reform advocates, but perhaps it's the first step in getting rid of money in this whole equation.
My name is Edwin Soto. I'm a bail recovery agent here in New York City. A lot of the bail bondsmen or posting agents here in New York feel that every penny counts, no matter if it's a misdemeanor crime that justifies or warrants a $1,500 bail versus a felony or a one felony count that justifies a remand or $200,000 or $250,000.
For Edwin and Eduardo, these new bail reforms in New York will barely make a dent in what they get paid right now.
And my attitude basically is, hey, there is enough here to keep this amount of agencies, okay? You look at the population. How many people are locked up across the street, more or less, ballpark?
About 19,000 in MDC alone. And that's 19 floors of all defendants.
Listen to Edwin speak the business lingo of how defendants become cash and how judges can sometimes make bad decisions.
My point of view, I believe that some of these cases or these charges that are being presented to grand juries or to the judges or to the arraignment judges sometimes are tedious. For example, you have a defendant that just hopped a train. That warrants violation. That warrants maybe an ACD. However, they'll justify with a $1,500 misdemeanor bail. How do you get a defendant that couldn't pay the turnstile and hop the train, and now you want him to pay $1,500?
In this case, a steep cost for jumping the turnstile, and $1,500 buys you your freedom. But what happens if you skip bail and don't show up in court? Well, someone calls Edwin in that case, but you better not call Edwin a bounty hunter. He's a bail recovery agent.
At the end of the day, that's what we are. We're bounty hunters. However, here in New York, we're not allowed to be called bounty hunters because bounty hunters need insurance companies or private investigators. The bail bond company can hire internal bail recovery agents that, empowered by the bail bondsman or the posting agent, gives us the right to surrender that individual back to court.
A side of the criminal justice system that is not much talked about but is essential to keeping the $8 billion pretrial criminal operation in America going each day, where on any given day, 60% of the U.S. jail population is composed of people awaiting trial. Nicholas Wachinski, Executive Director Emeritus of the American Bail Coalition, thinks of what he does as assembling a team to put up resources to help a defendant out.
Once that person has made a mistake, the agents in the industry receive notice, and they generally contact the loved ones. We call it the circle of responsibility or the circle of love. They are able to bring in the accused and have that person understand that they've made a mistake.
All of these folks have done well by this bail system for all of its mistakes. Bond agents can make from $50,000 to well over $100,000 a year holding down the fort in this little scrutinized back room of the criminal justice system. Eduardo Guiarte is part of this constituency that might recognize a few problems, but wouldn't change much in this system.
Yes, it does work, okay, because you're talking about a justice system for a country. It's not perfect. It's got a lot of flaws. I can tell you many, many things, okay, that are not perfect. But it is one of the best justice systems in the planet.
The more people who confidently believe that this is one of the best justice systems on the planet, the less likely that any radical reform will happen in the varied bail systems around the country, where each day freedom and the constitutional presumption of innocence is quite literally up for sale. If you want to listen back to the other parts of our series on the bail system in America, go to thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is supported by Citrix, creator of GoToMeeting, connecting people and businesses in face-to-face online meetings from any device, featuring a personalized meeting room for a custom look. Learn more at GoToMeeting.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry, and here's a politically unlikely group of pals. California Democratic Senator Barbara Boxer, Republican Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, and Republican Senator James Inhofe of Oklahoma have been working on a bipartisan long-term bill that would replenish the Federal Highway Trust Fund, which runs out of money in 11 days. Here's McConnell on the issue, sounding almost mushy, like he just got out of a hot tub.
My good friend, the Democratic leader, was saying as recently as a couple of weeks ago, we need to do a long-term highway bill. Well, Senator Boxer and I took him seriously, and we worked hard here to come up with a bipartisan, multi-year, paid-for highway bill.
The House of Representatives passed only a five-month extension bill last week, but the Senate hopes their long-term solution will end the latest uncertainty over highway funding. It's one of the issues on Capitol Hill. We're going to talk with Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick now. Todd, welcome to the Takeaway.
Hi, John.
So everyone's happy about highway spending?
A lot of people in the Senate are happy because there weren't a lot of predictions that they would be able to do a deal like this. The deal isn't done, but cast your mind back to the annals of congressional dysfunction. John, since 2007, do you know how many times Congress has done a temporary little pothole fill, a little patch, a little temporary fix of the Highway Trust Fund? Just the Highway Trust Fund, 33 times, 33 times around the block, and they haven't managed to come up with a cohesive deal on the Highway Trust Fund. And it's a big deal. These are highway projects in all 50 states, every territory across the country, funded by the gas tax, the excise tax that you pay 18.4 cents per gallon when you pump gas. That hasn't gone up since 1993, and Congress isn't going to raise it. So they need to find another deal, and that's what Mitch McConnell is talking about. 3 years this would fund the Highway Trust Fund, $45 billion, but Congress can't raise taxes, can they? Not in this environment. They can raise fees, though. So TSA fees when you fly, those aren't going up, but instead of putting them into the general treasury, the Highway Trust Fund will take that. They're allowing some mortgage lenders to increase reporting requirements. They think they might get more enforcement money out of that. How about selling 101 million barrels of oil from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve? They're going to raise some money that way, too. There's a long list of ways to pay for this. Don't call any of them a tax increase. And McConnell and Boxer might have themselves a deal here.
Will they go along in the House?
Well, that's a big question. The House passed a five-month patch because they want to try to do something completely different after the August recess and after the new year. But here's part of the complication. It has to do with a lot of other issues. Senators want to bring back the Export-Import Bank. It went away because conservatives killed it on July 1st. Mitch McConnell wants to have a vote to attach it to this Highway Trust Fund. A lot of Republicans, many of them conservatives in the House, don't want that. They're going to have a fight over this, but Republicans in the Senate are going around saying privately, a lot of Republicans in the House, including John Boehner, like this deal, and if we send this $45 billion fix to the Highway Trust Fund over there, they're probably going to take it. We'll have to see.
We're a week into the 60-day countdown on the Iran deal. What's the tone of folks there up on the Senate floor?
Well, from Republicans in the House and the Senate, John, complete opposition. You've heard it. You've heard their opposition to the deal, to the president, and to John Kerry on this. Democrats divided, most of them keeping their powder dry, except for Nancy Pelosi, who came out strongly for this deal, and that was a boom for President Obama on selling this deal. Hillary Clinton, the Democratic frontrunner, also said she was for it. So that clock is ticking. Ernest Moniz, who's a physicist and the Secretary of Energy, on the Hill today and tomorrow, along with John Kerry, in classified briefings in the House and the Senate to try to sell this deal, which is probably going to be rejected by Congress. The question is, do they uphold a veto coming up after Labor Day?
The veto-proof question, and we will examine it after Labor Day. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, thanks so much.
You got it.
Support for the Takeaway comes from Lumosity. Introducing a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving. With brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program, performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
Former CEO of Reddit, Ellen Pao, would have us all believe that she is a casualty of a battle for free speech, and in particular hate speech, on the internet. In an op-ed piece published to answer her critics, she wrote, quote, "Trolls are winning the battle for the internet." Reddit, the company she was forced out of, which has become an internet town hall, 146 million people, convening to converse every month dedicated to the principle that you can say virtually anything about anything to anyone. But in a world where 40% of all online users experience some kind of bullying and where 70% of young people between 18 and 24 say they have been harassed abusively online, Ellen Pao wants stricter controls over discussions that become hateful and abusive. Such controls are also a great way to attract deep-pocketed advertisers, something Reddit also needs to do to make money. At the Blog Her conference held in New York City last week, Shireen Mitchell, founder of the D.C.-based nonprofit Digital Sistas, said abusive speech should not be treated as discussion. It should be prosecuted like the crime of assault.
When there were threats in social media against the police department, there was arrests made.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
So there is precedent that we could utilize for ourselves as well. And one of the other challenges that we have is the concept that what's happening is just name-calling, but we need to understand that death threats is not a form of free speech,
no.
And it's not protected.
Yep.
So when that happens, actions should be taken.
Manu Zamarodi is the host of Note to Self, a WNYC podcast. She says Reddit sits astride a critical dividing line in the development of the internet right now. It just might be that Reddit's success as a business could depend on its sacrificing the idea of no rules free speech on the internet. Reddit will never be another Facebook, she says, until it figures this out, and there may be no way for Reddit to figure it out.
It's big. It has millions and millions. It's in the top 10 of traffic drivers on the web, but in terms of making money, it's not a big player. It kind of hasn't quite figured out how to take all those forums about absolutely everything and turn it into cash. It makes, you know, single-digit millions every year.
What is it in terms of the way you would distinguish it from other social media? I mean, is it a giant public square? Is it a lot of people sort of shouting on the corner? What is it?
It's kind of like old school message boards. So there's what they call subreddits on absolutely every topic you can possibly imagine, from the broadest, like politics, to I heard that somebody in this building at WNYC actually moderates a forum about music videos that have gotten less than 50,000 views on YouTube.
Well, that's essential.
Something idea, for everyone.
The idea is to deal with all kinds of subjects, yep. And especially subjects that wouldn't be covered by any other kind of media.
Exactly.
And so in that situation, who is a troll?
Well, you know, I think it depends on your definition of what is trolling. I think the people who are maybe on the rape philosophy board don't consider themselves trolls. They have a place to go, though, to discuss their issues. There are lots of other subreddits that also have incredibly offensive comments and discussions. I would consider them those trolls, but not necessarily any. Maybe they don't consider themselves trolls.
How is this environment and how is the Ellen Pao situation different from what used to be the case in Usenet, where you could go to Usenet and find out a million different things? I mean, you could find, you know, animals and grandmothers. I mean, it was just the weirdest stuff, and nobody talked about it, and it just was completely under the radar.
Well, I think what we're coming to is a point on the internet, which was founded on free speech, where people are saying, wait a minute, we need to have boundaries. So the new CEO at Reddit, his name is Steve Huffman. He's actually one of the original founders of the site. There are new policies. So he has said that anything that looks like outright harassment, bullying, or abuse is now banned, but as Huffman puts it, they are banning behavior, not ideas. So just plain old offensive content can still exist, although there will be new boundaries for these offensive forums, as we're calling them. Users will have to opt in, and Reddit won't make money off of them with advertising.
Is this because they care about manners, or is this because they want to attract sponsors, and this is the only way to monetize Reddit, which, of course, is the huge problem and one of the problems that led to Ellen Pao's departure?
I mean, I think that's the big issue for Reddit, right? How do you hold on to a vast amount of traffic that keeps your business afloat while not scaring away advertisers and other people who don't feel okay with having those things? they haven't figured it out yet. They are going to sort of lead the way, I think, for a lot of these other forums, or this could bring them down. There are other sites popping up and that are siphoning some of the people who don't want to have restrictions on them, placed on them.
What do you make of the Ellen Pao narrative in all of this? The trolls are winning, she says.
Mm-hmm.
But in looking at Reddit, I mean, there is no such thing as free speech on Reddit in the way that we understand it in the Constitution. I mean, they can say that there's free speech, but there's no guarantee of free speech on the Internet. So when you start making rules in a place like Reddit, what are you doing? Is it corporate regulations that we're talking about here, which is the same for any kind of a corporation? Or is it something fundamentally different? Is it kind of a legal operation that they're going on now, creating rules of speech that will have to be enforced?
I think what you're talking about, Reddit falls smack right in the gray space between all of that, right? On the one hand, yes, it's corporate. Condé Nast owns it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they haven't really stepped into the fray. On the other hand, it was founded by these two dudes, like, to be a place where people could talk about whatever they wanted to. That's where the internet is right now. Competing interests, corporate interests. How do we make money? How do we survive? How do we stay true to the original principles? And I don't think anyone has figured it out, which is why the Reddit case is so fascinating, right? Whether it wants to be or not, it's going to have to forge the way in terms of figuring out what are the laws of this new online society.
Is the historical milestone here is that Reddit has turned free speech into a brand from a legal concept?
That's what it was branding itself as, but I think it realized, in admitting this, it is changing its branding in saying we have a harassment problem, we have a bullying problem. By acknowledging that, that's a huge step for them. Whether or not they take more action other than the very sort of minimal ones they've taken so far will change the narrative of what happens to this company. And not to get weird and philosophical on you, John, but
please,
like,
get weird and philosophical.
I mean, maybe it's a good thing to see what needs to be dealt with in society. Maybe it's good that we see hate in black and white and our real problems instead of just seeing the world as we wish it was. You know, I think so many of us before the internet didn't know how other people were living or what they thought or the real dark issues of society. And now we can actually see them, and they are not pretty. So this is a new conversation, I think, for America.
Manoush Zomorodi, host of the podcast Note to Self. Thanks so much.
Great to be here, John.
And before we go, the angel Gabriel is said to have revealed the Holy Quran to the Prophet Muhammad at about the year 610. There is no first Quran and no discussion of whose handwriting that first Quran might have been written in, Gabriel's or Muhammad's. But a manuscript of fragments that might come close has been sitting in the University of Birmingham for a century. Carbon dating of the goat or sheepskin on which it was written places it from between 568 and 645, which makes it perhaps the oldest Quran, more than 1,300 years old. No clear identity on the handwriting, though. That's all for today. You can always respond to anything you heard on today's program. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or comment at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org. And curious.com, helping people grow skills in areas like programming and parenting. Broadcasting a live discussion on how to raise an adult this Thursday with author Julie Lithcott-Hames at 9:30 p.m. Eastern. Learn more at curious.com/PRI and LegalZoom. For over 10 years, working to help Americans navigate the legal system. With assistance on business formations, wills and trusts, trademark registration, and patents, legal help is at LegalZoom.com.